Hilary Hahn has been visiting Paris since she was just a teenager. She just loves the whole mood of it, everything about Paris. About 3 years ago, she started a residency with Miko Franck and the Philharmonic Orchestra of Radio France. That's when the idea came to them, they should do a recording. Well, it's finally happened. It's called Paris, and it features a world premiere of a composer's last work. It's all coming up on this edition of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher. Hilary, I would like to start by just asking how you are, what's life been like for you and your family over the past year during the global pandemic?
What a question, right? How has life been during a global pandemic for the past year? It's been life during a pandemic. I think we all have a differing experience of it. And I think it's important to remember that, it's possible to have multiple different kinds of experiences within a new circumstance. I found that it takes a lot of energy to adapt. And so for me, I'm focusing a lot on the moment and on, as a performer, not knowing what's coming up, just on getting myself ready so that whatever happens, when it happens, I'm ready for it.
And do I remember that you have a couple of little ones now, too, that you're spending time with? And how old are they?
They're 2 and 5 years old. It's life with a pandemic with little kids. I mean, I think everyone can kind of guess how it is. they're fine. I'm really fortunate that we're all in good health, and it's not an ideal circumstance to be in a pandemic, to not be able to have much of a community to rely on and to socialize with. But at the same time, it's a different lifestyle. So I've just been thinking about, what is good and what is challenging and sort of what works in this time that could carry forward into the future. I have to be a master at adaptation with my career, just because I show up for a concert and I get 2 rehearsals with an entire orchestra and then we play a concert, right? And so I have to be able to pivot in the moment. And then also with travel, there's so much you can't control. The flight is delayed, under normal circumstances. It's a lot of unknowns, and I enjoy adapting and figuring things out. So in the course of the pandemic, I was on a sabbatical for a year starting in September of 2019. I've played 2 weeks in public since then. I played 2 weeks in the fall, but I've done some virtual stuff. And I think it's interesting to see what musical experiences people are enjoying and what the experience is for an audience and what the experience is for a performer. Because I really do think some of these formats are now, a lot of these experiences that we're having virtually would be doable in between more typical performance experiences. And it's a chance to connect with people more globally, all at the same time. I had a listening party for my album over the weekend, and there were people from literally all over the world. Like, there wasn't a part of the world that wasn't covered. And I would never have been able to hang out with them in one place, but doing it online is now a really interesting way of connecting, and people have a way to understand the experience so that they can connect with it personally as well.
Oh, that's interesting. So were they able to actually communicate directly with you, that many people? How did you manage that?
Well, we were all in a chat together while we were listening. It was really cool. People from South America, people from Europe, people from Asia, people from Australia, people from everywhere, Canada.
Were there any themes that you heard from them as you saw them commenting about the music they were hearing?
Well, it was the first time that I've sort of felt an in-the-moment reaction since I started my sabbatical. Usually in concert, there is the audience reaction. It's a lot of people very close to you, and you can sense it. I did have 2 weeks of in-person concerts in the fall, and I really could sense the audience there, but then I couldn't see them after because it wasn't it just wasn't safe to do that. And normally I do a lot of post-concert signings and stuff like that, and I really meet the fans. So it was really nice. It's possible to connect and to connect around the same thing. And the music was playing, so there was a lot of just talk about the music.
You've mentioned your sabbatical, and then the pandemic hit. So I'm curious, was the original intention of the sabbatical able to be fulfilled, or did that change in any way?
That's a good question. The point of a sabbatical for me is to not have any plans. So just to see where life goes and see what I can learn about my natural patterns, and then incorporate those into my planning ahead for my concerts. So basically with my concert life, I plan 2 or 3 years ahead, and I'm always really happy about the stuff that arrives when it finally arrives 2 years after the idea was first started. And at the same time, you can build on a whole series of things that ultimately may not grow in the same direction that you are growing as a person. And you just keep being excited about what's coming up, and then you arrive at that day, and then you plan something else off of that. And so for me, it's just really helpful in a sabbatical to stop and not have expectations and not have goals, and just see, okay, am I a person at this point in my life who likes to get up early? Am I a person who is more creative, or more like want to go out hiking, or, you know, what kinds of things do I want to do? What do I want to find out? And am I a person who really misses being on the road, or do I actually suddenly love being a homebody? And of course, that was tested in a different way than I expected this year. But I actually wound up spending the first 3 months of the sabbatical — it was a year-long planned sabbatical — I spent the first 3 months just decompressing from basically the prior 10 years, because a lot has happened for me in the last 10 years. And the last time I took an intentional sabbatical was 10 years before. So I was kind of letting things settle, letting the cards fall where they may, and just taking some deep breaths and being in the moment and just sort of enjoying a smaller routine day to day. And then in my second semester of sabbatical, I wound up taking a bunch of art classes. I was going to a lot of concerts. I was going to museums. I had a subscription to the ballet. I never have a subscription to anything because I'm traveling, so it's unlikely I'll be able to make all of the concerts or all of the performances. So I thought, ooh, I'll do that thing. I'll get a subscription. And then the third semester was getting used to the pandemic, and also realizing there was a lot I didn't know about the world and about America and about social context and inclusion and social justice and all of these things that I should have already known about as an American, but somehow, had the privilege to not be forced to learn in the way that was reflective of reality for so many people who don't feel seen and heard and who aren't seen and heard. And so I then pivoted from getting ready to go back on a performing circuit, which I was starting to do already in March. I was getting back in playing shape. I pivoted from that, and I just put all my work time into learning and researching and examining and trying to see how I can do a more representative and more equitable approach to everything I do, including all of my projects. And so I was just putting those things in place and thinking about that and really examining it. And then the fourth semester was basically summer. And so by that point, I had some really favorite hiking places, and I was starting to think about how to re-enter performing when it was clear that performing would look different. So that was the sabbatical. And then in September, I did a bunch of virtual stuff. I did virtual residency. I did world premieres of things I had commissioned. The post-production of the Paris recording was finished. The AI community I co-founded with, sort of AI and music combination community I co-founded with the roboticist Carol Riley, who's a friend of mine, that we launched also in the fall. And we're really trying to create a positive space for AI scientists and musicians and creatives to interact in a positive way and a productive way in the future, because those fields are going to overlap a lot. And so the more we can increase communication amongst the people who are actually doing the things that are in those communities, the better.
That's interesting. I want to ask you how you see those communities overlapping, and then I want to dive into your recording.
Sure. Well, our organization is called deepmusic.ai, and we first started by commissioning three composers to work with existing AI tools. I played a piece by David Lang, and Michael Abels wrote a piece that was premiered by Dominic Cayley, and Dana Leong wrote a piece, a symphonic work that he premiered by recording himself playing multiple instruments and synthesizing some others, because right now it's not really orchestra time. But the idea behind the community is that AI is here. AI is in everything, and it doesn't need to be scary. The whole conversation is not about whether AI will take away jobs. The conversation is more, how can AI really be helpful to the fields that it's entering? And how can we as musicians also positively influence the future via influencing the direction of some of these things that are being created with AI? So basically, the long story short is that the thing that makes people is their creativity and emotions. And those are things that go into art, but those are really hard things for AI to capture. The spontaneity, creativity, the connection between people through art. And if AI can get to a point where it can, quote, understand that process, then the other programs that AI is involved in, the other applications of AI in the world that art is sort of a blueprint for, that art is the litmus test for, will be improved as well, because there aren't that many people working on these things at the moment. And once code is developed, once certain like methods of working are developed, those become the basis. So right now is a good time to actually have a conversation going, not just AI presenting to artists and artists listening and vice versa, but really trying to find the people who want to talk to each other, who like talking to each other, and connect them, and also maybe highlight some of the issues people are concerned about. Maybe just present those and say, hey, okay, so here's what we found. And we're just following the natural flow of what evolves out of these conversations and this community that we're starting to build. But it's important to work on that behind the scenes stuff in addition to all of the fun things that are being produced through AI and the arts.
Well, let's dive into your recording. We'll travel to Paris now, which is one of your favorite cities. Why do you love Paris so much? And tell me a little bit about your relationship with this orchestra and how the two of you have grown together.
Well, I love Paris because it's a great city. It's hard to put it all in one sentence. Paris is a place that I've visited since I was a teenager, and it has this mood to it. It's really an evocative city. Maybe I know too much about the history and I'm just applying it to the city, but I love the feel of the arts in Paris. There are so many beautiful museums. There are all these parks that are just works of art in their own right. As you walk through the city, you're walking through basically an art installation, it feels like. And it's a huge place. It's been, for many different reasons over the centuries, it's been a place where a lot of different cultures meet and collide and overlap and enrich each other. And also it's been a place where artists really meet up and discuss things and compare ideas, especially back in the days of the Salon, when there would be these, I guess, house parties for artists to all meet up and display their works and have discussions. I think about Paris when writers used to frequent certain cafes, and anyone who was visiting Paris who wanted to meet their friends who were artists or writers, they knew where to go to find them. And then they would just stay up all night hanging out and talking about art. I just really love that about that city. I can feel it when I'm there. It feels like that history has carried through.
You have a very special relationship with the orchestra featured on this recording, and it sort of culminated with your artist residency in 2018-2019, and that also helped to inspire this recording. Can you talk about that initial inspiration, please?
We had this artist residency that I did with Radio France, and it included a lot of touring with this orchestra. It included concerts in Paris. And we started out with some summer festival performances in France. We also, so I had solo Bach recitals for Radio France. And the very first concert that we all did in the residency, I realized that the residency had pretty much everything except a recording coming out of it. And we, by that point, knew that we would have the Rautavaara world premiere posthumously. We also were just playing together in a way that felt like magic. And what I've learned is that the collaboration is incredibly important for a recording, and that if you wait 2 or 3 years, the collaboration may have changed. Because I've worked with this orchestra a lot through different music directorships. They're the orchestra that I work with in Paris since I was a teenager. And so we've worked on a lot of repertoire, and an orchestra always evolves. A soloist always evolves. Conductors always evolve. And when you have something great in the moment, if you can capture as much of that as possible, it's really important. So a combination of things led to us, Miko, the conductor, and I just putting our heads together and saying, where in the season can we make a recording? Because everything was already planned. Like, where can we do the pieces that we want to do? Which pieces do we want to do besides the Rautavaara? And we added Prokofiev 1 and Chausson to the residency for this recording.
The Rautavaara was a piece that you were hoping to do, and Miko is one of the leading interpreters of his music. There is a moment, though, when you weren't sure it was going to happen. Can you talk about that, I guess, sort of a magical situation that actually occurred after his passing that made this actually come to life?
This piece is a story of relays, literally passing the baton, although maybe literally isn't quite apt. But, you know, there's a conductor's baton that got activated at some point in the process. But the first idea for it came actually from a collaboration I did with Miko Frank and this orchestra on Rautavaara's violin concerto. I had already commissioned Rautavaara to write me a duo piece for violin and piano for my Encores project. And I premiered that and then recorded that. And Miko was an incredibly close friend of Rautavaara. He performed everything there was to perform for an orchestra, the operas, the symphonic works, and also just personally, they were incredibly close. So when he asked me to do the violin concerto that Rautavaara had already written, that had already been premiered, I jumped at the opportunity because I loved the piece, but I hadn't learned it before. Sorry, lots of noises. They're dragging furniture now. It's a furniture studio, so every so often they rearrange. Oh no, now they're vacuuming. Can you hear it? No, they're using a shop vac. This is spectacular amounts of sound. Oh no. They're using a bandsaw. Can you hear that? There's no way you don't hear that. Okay, what was I talking about? Oh, Rautavaara. The composer was ill at the time that I performed the violin concerto with Miko and with the L'Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France. But he heard the concert recording, and I had talked with Miko during the rehearsals for that concert about potentially another piece by Rautavaara, to commission Rautavaara to write another piece for us, maybe another violin concerto. And that's the last I heard of anything, because Mikko said, well, I don't think this is a good time because of his health, but if I see him soon and I can talk to him about it, I will. So I didn't hear anything else. And it turned out Mikko had talked with him. They discussed the idea of serenades instead of a concerto, because Rautavaara wasn't wild about writing the same format again. But he had been very interested in the serenades. And so they settled that that would be it. And then Mikko went back to touring. And the next that we heard, Rautavaara had passed away. So it seemed like he hadn't gotten to any more of this piece. Then at the funeral, Mikko was at the house with Rautavaara's widow, and she showed him this manuscript for two serenades. It was titled in French, which was very unusual for Rautavaara. Usually he titled things in English, and everything has Finnish titles as well. But it was clearly the piece that he was working on for us. It was almost done. The violin part was done, the solo violin part, the orchestration was done for the first serenade, and the second serenade, the orchestration was complete about halfway through. And then there was a very clear sketch that had been already edited and worked over by Rautavaara that he was just orchestrating from to kind of have final parts. So it was very, very clear what the score was going to be. And at that point, Kalevi Aho finished the piece in the style that Rautavaara would have wished. And Kalevi was a student of Rautavaara's and also a great Finnish composer in his own right. So it really kind of came full circle when Mikko and I premiered it, and Rautavaara's community was there, but he was not. But he was there in spirit. It is the last work that he wrote. He was he lived to be in his 80s, and he was a protege of Sibelius. He was such a figure in the contemporary music scene in the 20th century. And he had tremendous influence on a certain type of composer who wanted to work with a more tonal palette, but still be innovative and individual. I think that Rautavaara's writing made it okay for people to express themselves in a beautiful, lush way. He composed a lot around the themes of life and death and darkness and light and sort of the boundaries between them. So it's really fitting that this final work of his ends on a more, I think, on a broader spectrum of a serenade for my love, which was for his wife, but it's also a look back at a lot of his work and a lot of his styles combined with new material. The Serenade for Life, which he passed away while completing, he didn't get to complete the orchestration, and it's very clear where it stops. At one point, the staves, the lines are just suddenly empty, and you turn the page, and it's just a blank page. But it's pretty fitting that he left those two pieces as his final works, because Mikko has told me, you know, of course, Eino Juhani Rautavaara would want to have the last word. And so he left the last word. And it's also a tribute, you know, it's a tribute to life. It's a sort of meditation on love and looking back at one's life, at the end of one's life.
The poem by Ernest Chausson is a work that you say takes your breath away. Why is that?
It's It's a huge piece. It's not the biggest, longest piece in the repertoire, but it's a symphonic orchestration. And yet Chausson knew how to take the violin, the solo violin part, down to nothing. It really goes from as big a sound as you can make with an orchestra to as small a sound as you could have on a stage. So when the orchestra enters, they set the whole framework for the piece. And then when I enter, everyone, after the end of my first note, has stopped playing, and I then set the framework for the rest of the interpretation together. It's a piece that I can't drive. I have to be free within the piece. I have to be supported by the orchestra and the conductor, but also they need to have their own interpretation that I work with in my interpretation. And so having them take ownership of their work is something that gives me goosebumps. Like every time I finish my part and then the orchestra takes it further, it just is spectacular. And it is such a dark but beautiful piece. It really feels like a requiem for the composer himself. Is the piece that put him on the map as a composer. And in the course of a few years after that, he had passed away in a bicycling crash. And so it's really, for me, also breathtaking that this phenomenal work exists. Like, he got it written. He was destined to write this work, and he wrote it, and we get to play it and hear it as long as we want.
Prokofiev's Violin Concerto No. 1 had its premiere in Paris, which is why it's on this recording. You've said that this work is very life-affirming for you. What do you mean by that?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't remember what day I said that, but I love this piece so much. It's really, it brings you through, I think, the entire landscape of what it is to be human. It's like Prokofiev had a Rolodex not only of techniques and musical styles, but also all the emotions and all of the scope of the soul. And somehow he gets to all of it in the course of a pretty short concerto. It's like you step on the train and you have this wild journey. And then when you arrive, you're like, whoa, what just happened? And where am I? And that was amazing. So for me, it's really this larger than life work that takes full concentration and really carries you as both a performer and a listener.
What was most memorable for you in putting this recording together?
The collaboration. It was a labor of love. Like, we all really wanted to make this recording, and we all knew that we were making it because there was something really special happening musically in this collaboration. It's just one of those moments in time that you can't manufacture and you can't predict it, but it's palpable. And when you're playing with colleagues who are building on what you're doing and giving you musical ideas to build on, and they're playing things in ways you could never have imagined, but you love it. It's just, it's breathtaking and it's amazing. And every time I hear the recording, I'm thrown right back into those feelings of working with them at that time. It was a really poignant experience of making music with people. So I really treasure that even more now, because it's not an inexhaustible resource. And it's a really, really crucial part of being a musician to be able to have those experiences.
Hilary Hahn's new recording, Paris, featuring her with Miko Frank and the Philharmonic Orchestra of Radio France. Since you're clearly a music fan, let me tell you about another podcast I think you'd like. It's called the Piano Puzzler Podcast, where each week Fred host... where each week host Fred... You can always tell I'm doing this late on a Friday, right? Where each week host Fred Child invites composer Bruce Adolph into the studio to play one of his brilliant musical mind games. And Bruce takes a familiar tune and he disguises it in the style of a classical composer. And then a contestant, maybe you, calls in and tries to solve the riddle. It's a lot of fun. You can subscribe to The Piano Puzzler wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're enjoying this podcast, New Classical Tracks, the absolute best thing that you can do for the show is tell somebody else about it. Help spread the word and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. Thanks to Valerie Kaler, the producer for New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Macher.